Welcome to the ABM Conversations Podcast, the number one podcast for B2B marketers wanting to explore timeless account-based marketing strategies to drive revenue, customer engagement, retention, and everything that makes sense to both marketers and sales folks. No more fluff. No more vanity metrics. Live from India, made for the world. And now your hosts, Yog and Manish.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the ABM Conversations podcast. This is me, your host, Yagneshwaran Ganesh.
And this is me, Manish Nepal.
All right. In today's episode, we are going to be discussing how you can make use of customer data to improve their experience and thereby increase the customer lifetime value. And when it comes to a topic like this, where we need expertise, we better get an expert, right? So we have Juliana Jackson, the chief evangelist at OmniConvert, joining us all the way from Bucharest. So Juliana, welcome to the show. How are you?
I am fine and really happy to be here with you guys today. I've been a big fan of the podcast, so it's good to be on this side of it right now.
Thank you so much. That means a lot to us. All right, so let's jump straight into the core of our conversation today. So right now, you know, Juliana, if you look at it, almost everyone, especially in the world of e-commerce, they are talking about what would happen once the third-party cookies are completely gone. You know, what is the kind of customer data that they can rely on, so on and so forth. So before we get into how to use customer data, let's get some fundamentals sorted, right? Let's talk a little about what are the different types of customer data that is available today and what it means to marketers. And maybe, you know, if you can address the elephant in the room as to what data, according to you, is more reliable and probably also in your control once third-party data is gone.
Awesome. Well, it's a broad question. So basically, right now, there's a lot of types of customer data and there's a lot of names for it. As you probably know, it's a very common thing in marketing to use the same concept and rename it in different ways. But from my point of view, there are three types of data. It's actually four because, you know, I don't want to upset you with your article with the zero party data. But for me, it's three, which is a first party data. And that's the information that a company collects on its customer. So it's it's sourced from a variety of direct customer and business interactions, which include transactional behavior, customer feedback, the usage of apps, and so on. Then you have the second party data, which is some sort of first party data as well, but that's the data that is shared between organizations. So a good example is if you have a summit and you have people that are sponsoring your summit, it's an understanding between the organizers and the sponsors to share the data from those leads. And then that's how that customer, how that company gets access to that customer data. And then you have the third party data, which is basically the information that's been collected and compiled by our organization with no direct link to the subjects of the data. So it's a very fuzzy data, very uncertain when it comes to the source of it. And it's something that's starting to get shut down. Actually, it started to get shut down since 2019. And first was Facebook that stopped the use of third-party data in their advertising. Soon Twitter followed, and now Google will too from 2022. So basically, this leaves the whole online advertising companies that are so dependent on customer on third-party data very, very, you know, in the unclear. So in my opinion, to go back to your question, for me, the most important type of data is the first party data because it's like the most valuable currency of the digital world. And it's valuable because marketers using it, it provides them with a lot of information on customer behavior, but it's also extremely trustworthy and controllable because it hasn't been handled before by different sources and different people. So yeah, there's also zero party data, which is the information, as you state in your blog, that the customer intentionally shares with the brand.
That is brilliantly put, Juliana. And I totally agree about banking more on the side of first party data because it's your own, right? So that's definitely an advantage for brands. And yeah, for listeners who are not clear about the fourth kind of data, the zero party data that Juliana just referred to, it's the kind of data that customers proactively and voluntarily surrender to brands in order to maybe personalize the customer experience better. So I definitely think that also merits listing in the list of all kind of data. So thank you for clarifying that. But here is what I think I should ask you next, Juliana. And the question is, while we have so much first-party customer data lying around in our ecosystem across, let's say, CRMs or marketing automation systems and social media and whatnot, I think not everyone knows how to put those kind of first-party data to good use. So can you tell us how can marketers collect and make the most out of their first-party data that are spread across their systems?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, just to give you like a bit of context, I always thought that there was always a misalignment between the analytics department and the marketing department. And I'm not saying both of them have very good intentions, right? They all want, you know, the same thing for the company to grow. But they also work on different types of KPIs and different types of approaches. So the communication between the analytics and the marketing is not the best. So when this whole data-driven thing started in the marketing world, everyone was very obsessed to collect data. So people just started piling data. So it was like that. It was the understanding that the more data you have, the more data-driven you are. Unfortunately, they are sitting on a hot mess of data. So sometimes you don't know exactly what to do. And you're just looking as an agency or as an e-commerce, or as an agency that works with an e-commerce, you're just looking at fast wins, at tactical solutions. So you just go ahead and you don't necessarily think strategically when it comes to data. And to be honest, in the e-commerce world, there's only maybe like 5% of e-commerce companies that actually have a data analyst in their teams. It's more like e-commerce managers and marketing managers. So it's hard to grasp that, even if it's the most simple thing, because in an e-commerce environment, the first party data, it's basically all the data that you have about your customers through their ordering. So now that third party data is goodbye, the whole gold rush, it's all about the first party data, as I said before, which is the most valuable currency of the digital world because it gives you direct access into your customer behavior. So let me go a bit deep on this, if that's okay with you guys.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We are anyway going to ask you deeper questions, if you didn't cover, for sure.
Cool. So this is a topic that I'm super passionate about. So back in the mid-50s, Jan Rolf Bult and Tom Wansbeek wrote this article that supported the Pareto principle of the 80-20. So basically, he was saying that 80% of the business, the revenue was coming from 20% of the customers. And this was published in a magazine back then called Marketing Science. And this article was the first article that is dated to talk about RFM segmentation, recency, frequency, and monetary value analysis. So this study back there in the 50s was more surrounded about about the topic of product catalogs sent to customers of mail orders. So basically, people back then, they didn't have online shops, they were just ordering through mail. It was this very big catalogs of clothing that were looking like the gold pages. And people were looking, then they were sending the mail through order. And these guys here, Jan and Tom, realized that based on how people buy, on their recency, frequency, and monetary value, they can forecast into future customer behavior. So RFM analysis, and why I'm talking about this, is a very good source of how to visualize and get insights from first-party data. So this, as mentioned before, supports the whole idea of the 80% of the business comes from 20% of the customers. But to be able to determine which percentage is which is a very big problem in marketing, in my opinion, to understand which percentage does what, you need to understand the value of the customer. So the value of the customer, it's something that I always discuss about with the brands that I work with. And I ask them on many occasions, what's your relationship with your customers? Is this a long-lasting relationship? Or you are just heading to a nasty breakup with half of the customers in your database? So RFM, it's actually a method to answer to those questions. So to analyze and understand your customers based on these three factors of recency, frequency, and monetary value, it helps you predict which clients are more likely to buy again from you in the future. So this RFM model right now is highly used in e-commerce environments because it helps you understand how to segment your customer database based on this, based on recency, frequency, and monetary value to stimulate repeat purchases, to be able to delight customers, to be able to increase the frequency of the existing customers, but also to get a revenue. And by knowing these segments of customers, it's going to be much more easier for you as a marketer to communicate with them based on their behavior. And ultimately, this translates into a lower cost per acquisition because you know what type of customers you want to bring up to your shop, and an increase in a customer lifetime value. So to sum up, to not blow up the whole conversation, basically what RFM is, RFM segmentation is, it allows you as a brand to make a comparison between the cold audience that you have and the existing customer. So it gives you like a sense of how to, you know, how much revenue would you actually get from repeat customers versus the ones that are new. And what do you actually have to do to delight customers so they, you know, they stop, they start buying more from you? So yeah, that's my answer, I guess, in a very simple way of how to use this first party data and how to get it. It's simple if you use Shopify, if you use Magento, if you use BigCommerce, whatever. All your data is right there in your face. And a lot of people in e-commerce businesses are using email and they're using advertising. But unfortunately, they go and buy databases of audiences instead of looking at what they have in their own backyard. And that's why there's such a big, decline, especially now since COVID hit. It's a very big decline in the market because of the misuse of data and understanding the value of the data.
Absolutely love that in the sense it's important to look at what we have within our systems so that we'll be able to prioritize whom to spend our energies on. That made a lot of sense. Having discussed about segmentation, I think the obvious thing which you also touched upon a little bit is the lifetime value of a customer, right? What is generally known as the CLV. So, here's my understanding. Logically speaking, one would define CLV as the potential net profit that you would attribute to a customer during their lifetime with you. And that means you cannot look at CLV without considering your customer acquisition cost. For example, if your cost to acquire a customer is like, say, $200 and your subscription costs about $10 per month or maybe, $99 per annum or something like that, it doesn't make sense, right? Because your acquisition cost is already high. Or what if, the customer switches to a competitor in 3 months? So we would love to, understand, because you come from an e-commerce background, I think you can say this best. Like, how do you look at the ratio between CAC and CLV? And what, according to you, probably is a good ratio? Maybe, tell us a little about how we can leverage this to predict the potential success or failure with a customer.
Wow, that's a great question. And I'm trying to figure out how I will not speak for 30 minutes about this. So,
go on.
Customer lifetime value is the most sexiest thing right now in e-commerce. Why? So back in 2000, let's go back before COVID, everyone was so happy about doing acquisitions. And they were throwing money, and they still are, let's be honest. But everyone was funneling money on acquisitions channels, Facebook ads, Google ads. They were making all the, this big, social media platforms pockets fat with this money. Then COVID hits. Obviously, let's go back in May. In May and April, it was like a very big cleanup of e-commerce. So there were businesses that grew their sales to 35 to 45%, and there were businesses that were closed. The ones that were closed never did one day of retention in their life. So why I'm going to the retention part is because customer lifetime value helps you as a store to answer yourself to one question. How much is a customer worth? So clearly, if you don't have a healthy relationship between how much of a customer is worth to you versus how much does a customer cost, which is the customer acquisition cost, then you are clearly in the darkness. So when you combine these two questions, we get to a more important question. So the question is, to what extent is a customer worth their cost? So how much should you invest in bringing customers versus how much those customers are bringing to you? What extent are you going to invest? So in other words, what is the true value of a customer to your business? So that's exactly what the CLV-CAC ratio reveals. What's the true value of a customer to my business? So in the e-commerce world, as I said, this thing started being sexy after the pandemic started. And right now, a lot of businesses are focused on understanding what customer lifetime value is. And they're like rediscovering something that appeared in the 60s. And it's crazy because, in my opinion, maybe you guys will fight me on this, but everything that's worth mentioning in marketing in this year was invented in the 60s and the 80s. We are just regurgitating the same stuff in different words. So that's where the basis of marketing started. So CLV has always been the bread and butter of e-commerce. However, dealing with agencies, and I'm, you know, it's hard to, there's a lot of sneaky agencies, right? So these agencies move the attention from the e-commerce brand owner to being super acquisition centric. So to understand the ratio between CLV and customer acquisition cost, we have to stop a minute and look and think about one thing. Any business in the world has some maturity phases. If we talk about e-commerce, if you just if you have an e-commerce store, there's three phases that you will have to go through. It's the acquisition-centric phase, the product-centric phase, and the customer-centric phase. So Jay Abraham was saying there are three ways of growing a business. One of them was bring more customers. One of them, bring more products. And the third one, I think it was make customers that you already have to buy more. So given what Jay Abraham said, if we look at the maturity phases of an e-commerce, in the acquisition phase is when you just start. Clearly, you have to be acquisition-centric and you have to bring new customers in. It's how you're going to grow. You cannot grow from nothing. But then when you get to the product-centric phase, you start adding more products, more categories, but you still have that mentality from, you know, early days when you were desperate to bring new customers in. And only in the third part of the maturity, you get to the customer-centric phase when you understand things such as retention, as customer journey optimization, and customer lifetime value. But unfortunately, that acquisition phase, it's like a shadow that follows you throughout the whole business history. And you don't, you know, you, so there are some brands that don't get over it. The brands that are doing it good, you can see them online. It's the Nikes, it's the Gymsharks, it's, you know, all these big brands that we all know and love. But, you know, they are where they are because they understand how customer lifetime value works. So just to go back to your question on how to use this ratio to be able to predict the success or failure. This ratio doesn't exist like a magic number, right? To tell you, okay, this is the ratio that you have. But how can I put this? Most metrics right now are very contextual. This is the same thing goes for CLV and the cost per acquisition. And it has to do a lot with the maturity of the business, with the products, with the industry, and the brand in general. So there are a few things that you should be wary of when you do this, when you calculate this ratio for your business. So ratio that's like too low usually indicates that a brand is spending too much to acquire customers that aren't actually worth that much. So let's say you have a ratio of 1-to-1. That means the customer that you buy is paying you back exactly how much you pay to acquire them, leaving absolutely no space for profits. So that's a very bland ratio. If your CLV to CAC ratio though is less than 1-to-1, that means your business is going in the dumpster. You have to run because you're paying way too much to acquire customers, and something needs to be done immediately to change the way your business is going, because it's much more. This situation is even worse than the one you're breaking even, because here you're not wasting just time. It's just that every second that you stay in this situation, you're just going through financial pit. So just to like sum up, COV CAC ratio of 1:1. It means you're bringing money in the shop exactly as much as you spend. A lower one means that you are going into a financial ground hole and you need to get out of there right now. But, you know, like people are saying online, if you read about this CLV ratio, they say that the ideal one should be a 3.1. But this goal of 3.1 ratio needs to be, in my opinion, I guess, tailored based on the industry you are for the best results, because there's not, you know, it's not the same number that goes for every business. You have people that sell products, you know, just like that, but you have people that sell subscriptions. They it's a very different business model. But just one more thing, so I don't take too much time on this topic, I want to mention is that you don't want also your ratio to be high, that high, because the ratio that's too high, it shows that this brand isn't spending enough based on how their customers are actually worth. So if the customers are worth a lot to your business, then you have to invest, you know, basically to show them that, you know. So yeah, it's great that you have a high COV, but at the same time, if you don't, you know, show the customers that they are the bread and butter of your business, that thing is gonna, you know, affect you in the long term, because it's very deceiving. So I guess to answer to your question, there's not a magic number. There's not a good or a bad one. It's just, it has to be a balance between, you know, what you spend and what you are getting back.
That was actually very interesting, because what you said about the CLV, you know, the caution that you threw there about the CLV not being too high is very interesting to me, because I was of the impression, and I was going to recap your answer by saying, in my understanding, the higher the CLV, the lower the CAC ratio, the better. But based on your answer, that doesn't seem to be the case, which is very counterintuitive and interesting. Something to think about for all the marketers out there, especially in the e-commerce world, that banks on high CLV, right? So interesting. I want to move on and bring up a topic that is somewhat related to the CLV and CAC ratio that we just talked about. And Yag and I are witnessing this mad obsession of, you know, return on ad spend, or ROAS for short. The noise about it has only increased since COVID because of this massive explosion we are seeing in the e-commerce world right now. I mean, you belong to that domain, so you know this better than us. So as an e-commerce thought leader, Juliana, what's your take on the return on ad spend as a marketing metric? Number one question. And number two is, does it make sense to measure this metric as part of customer acquisition costs?
Oh, so this is a this is a subject that triggers me a lot. Okay. Yeah, so in short, no, ROAS shouldn't be considered when you calculate acquisition costs. That's the short answer. ROAS is a revenue metric and is the result of ad spend. So what you need to take in account when calculating cost, the CAC, you know, the acquisition cost, is the ad spend, not the ROAS. The ROAS contributes to the cost per acquisition, but it's not something that you should be, you know, taking into consideration, in my opinion. Because, let me go into deep. A customer acquisition cost is highly misunderstood in e-commerce. I'm not sure about B2B and SaaS. That's what you guys have to tell me after I answer, if it's misunderstood. But in e-commerce, it's super misunderstood. One thing is that the education in this matter, it's not the same, because a lot of people that start e-commerce businesses, direct-to-consumer businesses, are entrepreneurs, are people with a great idea that get the investment, and they just get there, and they're amazing, and they're customer-driven, and so on. But they don't have necessarily the marketing education or the data education, and that's why they're always going to podcasts and learning. So they're amazing, you know, brand owners are amazing, but they don't understand the specific of this. So the common mistake is that the customer acquisition cost and the cost per acquisition are confused a lot in e-commerce. But in reality, they're super different metric. And to be able to calculate your cost per acquisition, you have to understand the difference between them. So the cost per acquisition measures the cost to acquire something that is not a customer. God, I hope I make sense. So for example, a registration, an activated user, a trial, or a lead, right? That's the cost per acquisition. But the customer acquisition cost measures the cost to acquire a customer. These two metrics are related because the cost per acquisition is usually used to measure the cost of things that are like some sort of indicators to the cost per acquisition. So there are three big mistakes when calculating cost per acquisition. Mistake number one, you are not including the salaries. So to calculate it right, e-commerce brands that are listening to this, please include the salaries in your cost per acquisition cost. You need to include all of them, of the people that work in marketing and sales, not just the marketing people. And this includes not only the individual contributors, you know, that are your team, they're dedicated, but also, you know, the people that are spending, some part time in marketing as well. And it's also the agencies that you work with that, you know, help you with your marketing thing. And then mistake number two, you are not including the overhead. So similar to the same thing of not including salaries, you need to include the overhead in the cost per acquisition cost. So not thinking about the overhead, it's a big mistake because you need to include the rent, the equipment, and everything that's allocated to your employees working on marketing and sales. So the third mistake, it's actually one of the biggest mistakes. It's not including the money you spend on different tools that you use. So you use, I don't know, HubSpot, you use, I guess, all this Pipedrive, Hootsuite, all the softwares, you know, that are being used by your sales team and the marketing team, and you don't include them in the customer acquisition cost. So these three things are very, very important in the calculus of the customer acquisition cost. So salaries, overhead, and the tool. These are every e-commerce company that I talked to in the last time, you know, they don't include these costs. And they don't know, actually. And it's good that, you know, there's a lot of opportunity for them to understand, you know, financial metrics better. Because they make the confusion to say that my cost for acquiring customers is the same as the I spend on ads. That's why they think they are winning. But once they do this calculation right, they understand they're not necessarily winning. But yeah, Manish, to go back to the return per ad spend, there's a lot of talk about the return for ad spend in the space that I am, mostly because it's for brands is very important. And sadly, for most brands, ads are the only way to grow for them. And they don't understand why they have a bad return per ad spend. They don't understand why they have a bad COV. They don't understand why they're barely break even. So in my opinion, unless you go and sell on Mars or on Jupiter, you will have to bump heads with your competition. And this process makes you as a brand, I don't know, frustrated. So you just go into this vicious cycle of spending more and spending more on ads because of, you know, the lack of results. And you, instead of having a clear mind and see what's on the table, which is your existing customers, right? And their behavior and how can you can use them to, you know, to narrow down this pool, you know, that you're in. Instead of, you know, going ahead doing ads and spraying and praying, because that's how I call it, spraying and praying, you can use the RFM segmentation, for example, that I was talking about earlier, and create lookalike audiences based on your best customer profile. So a cool thing about RFM is that it's the best way for you to identify what is your ideal customer profile. Because as mentioned earlier, RFM segmentation helps you segment your customer database based on transactional behavior. So you will end up, I guess, with, I don't know, depends on the business size. You can have from 5 to 10 groups of people. And each group has the same buying behavior. So the people in the group have the same buying behavior. So let's say you have a group and it's called VIP customers. So VIP customers are a group that through the RFM analysis are assigned the score. The score is usually for RFM, ranging from 1 to 5, right? So if you have a VIP group, you will have a score of 555. 555 means recency 5, frequency 5, and monetary value 5. So it's the acronym, right? So you as a brand, if you have access to this group of VIP customers, which are people that buy from you frequently, they have high order values, it's so easy to take this group of people and create lookalike audiences campaigns on Facebook. And basically, instead of spending your money on acquiring new people that, you know, might not be interested in your product, you can go and, you know, get this new audience, but it's an audience that you have much more chances to convert. So in my opinion, the only solution for brands to increase revenue and sustain growth is to simply stop obsessing about the return per ad spend and instead adopt a lifetime value centered approach towards their marketing.
So we talked about customer acquisition cost. We talked about customer lifetime value and return on ad spend. You also touched upon CPM. But keeping those things aside for a while, I want to ask you something related to another important term that's very common in the e-commerce marketing space, and that is conversion rate optimization, or CRO. And I think I would go out on a limb and say that it's also the kind of concept that is kind of misunderstood in the SaaS and B2B world. So you did call out the right thing earlier. And if I'm not mistaken, Juliana, the problem I see with CRO in SaaS or e-com or everywhere else is that oftentimes marketers do all sorts of growth hacks in the name of improving conversion, right? And sometimes they will optimize things way too much to the extent of throwing the customer experience out of the window. Based on your widespread experience in the e-com niche, what are the 2 to 3 things that marketers using CROs should be aware of so that to not mess up the customer experience?
This is a great question. Thank you for that. If you guys saw the company I work for, we actually started in 2013 doing conversion rate optimization. So OmniConvert has 2 layers. It's a conversion rate optimization software, and it's also a customer value optimization software. So we started in 2013 with Explore, and we had over, I lost count, maybe 5,000 websites that were using OmniConvert Explore. So it's actually funny. In the summer, I did this a roundup with a lot of people from the CRO environment, and I asked them one question. Is CRO transcending through a customer journey optimization? So let me tell you how this came to happen. So we noticed from our own clients and a lot of the agencies that we have partnerships with that the lifetime value of a customer that does conversion rate optimization only as a growth strategy is very short. It's usually from 6 to 9 months. And this is not because the experimentation needs to stop, right? Obviously, you always should be testing, you always should be experimenting and, you know, increase the way you are, not increase, optimize the way you are serving information and content to your users or customers, be it e-commerce, be it, SaaS and B2B. And the situation was that because of the short periods of contracts with different clients on conversion rate optimization services was short, this happened because CRO alone cannot be a growth strategy, in my opinion. So this is my opinion, right? It cannot sustain the growth of the business on its own, the CRO. I'm not saying conversion rate optimization is not good. I hope people don't take that answer from me. No, conversion rate optimization is great, but alone will not be able to sustain the growth of a business, because doing a few tweaks on the website and changing 3 buttons and, I don't know, changing different variation doesn't mean, I don't know, nothing for me. So our vision at OmniConvert and Valentin's vision, because, Valentin, our vision was this, that the conversion rate optimization will merge into a much more comprehensive, way to design better customer journeys, you know, and making all these agencies that I was telling you guys about in the beginning, that promise all this, fast quicks to, you know, fall off their feet, because CRO has a bad name in the market because of the CRO agencies, because they promise a lot of things. And the thing is that in working in conversion rate optimization, people that are looking for services like this, they don't they want a quick fix to their problem. So they're looking for and they install a software. So they want to solve their strategy issues. So they just buy a software and install the software. And then they don't know what to do with it. And this is what happens. So people are not necessarily interested on long-term strategies. They just want short, quick wins. So if you know, if you're an agency, you have to adopt that mentality to offer quick wins to your customers. But unfortunately, conversion rate optimization is not something that happens in 5 minutes. You are probably well aware that it takes time and enough sample size to be able to come with statistical relevance from a test. Yeah, of course, you can get results from, you know, smaller sample size tests, but they take a lot of time to make sense for you. So you cannot just get a result. So because of that, sneaky agencies came up with this silver, I guess, I don't know, bullets, you know, of solutions that really ruined how CRO is perceived. So actually, my opinion on this, and it's the same thing I said in the roundup that I did, is that these times when people focus so much on A/B testing and hypothesis, which makes me roll my eyes so hard over my head that my head hurts, it's not going to count for growth anymore. I don't think conversion rate optimization will disappear as a method of growth. I think it's simply evolving into customer journey optimization, because the whole sales process doesn't end once the sale is done. So just to like make a short parenthesis to e-commerce, people changed, customers changed, especially since coronavirus hit. You have people that are first-time buyers that purchase for the first time online. You have people that used to be periodic buyers, but now they are buying consistently from the online. I am one. I used to buy like from time to time online. I know better, right? But now people are just buying online all the time. So the customer behavior changed. And it's in your interest as an e-commerce shop to understand what happens post-sale. So you don't have the customer journey is not only pre-sale, sale, and that's it, and fulfillment. The customer journey actually starts when the order has been delivered. Then is when it's your chance as a brand to intervene in this journey to increase repeat purchasing behavior. So for me, as a, I don't know, e-commerce professional, my biggest advice to people that are looking at CRO as a growth method is to calm down. It's good to do it, but you need to understand that a few tweaks on the website, it's not enough. You need to go and optimize the whole customer journey, because the new type of consumers that we have right now, they are high demanding, they are skilled, they are educated, they know what they want. And the moment you slack, that's how easy it is to use a customer. So that's my take.
CRO gremlins are going to come after you. I mean, there are a lot of people who think that changing color qualifies into CRO. So
exactly.
That's that. Anyway, you know, now that we have discussed in detail and we are inching close towards the 45-minute mark, now is the time for rapid-fire questions. Are you ready for it?
No. No. But yeah, I'm ready. I'm just this. When I was listening to your episodes, I was like, okay, what are they gonna ask me? Yeah, no, actually, I'm not ready, but I'm excited. So let's see what you.
Awesome. Let's see how it goes. All right. So here's your question number one: Shopify or WooCommerce, and why?
Oh. Okay. Shopify. No disrespect to the people at WooCommerce. They're amazing. They are doing their best. Okay, so Shopify, because Shopify has a much more clearer vision when it comes to benefit the e-commerce brand. WooCommerce is good if you have not too many expectations about you as a brand in terms of the services that you offer to your customers. There you go. I was very politically correct.
All right. Here's question number two. You've always said, the Black Friday and Cyber Monday is the time for retargeting. Why is that?
Oh my God. This is a great question. People on Black Friday and Cyber Monday just freak out. They just go crazy. Oh my God, let's go and get more customers. But there you are sitting with the whole customer database. And if you do RFM segmentation, yeah, you get this segment of customers called new passion, which is people that you acquired recently in the past, maybe 3, 4 months ago, 6 months ago. And this is people that paid for you in full price. Maybe these people that you acquired in the past that purchased just one time from you, maybe these people are waiting for you to give them a damn discount and to buy more. Instead, you as a brand, instead of looking at this group of people that you should be nurturing and loving on them and doing whatever just to delight them and to grow them to the point of Black Friday comes and Cyber Monday, this is where you should redirect all your marketing to these people that already bought from you. You earned their trust. And this is where you should go. You have much more chances to have these people that already bought from you buy again than random people that you just go fishing about on Facebook or on Instagram or Twitter or whatever. So yeah, I think that's how Black Friday should be thought of. And doing this make you pay less. There were so many crazy figures spent on this Black Friday. You probably saw on Shopify and people spend so much money on advertising. But at the end of the day, they're going to stay like this week. A lot of people are going to look at their cohort analysis and understand how much of shit customers they bought. Sorry.
I love that. I love this idea, what you just said, because, I think people can implement this. This should be tried out. And maybe, it's definitely going to bring down the cost. Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's much more easy. You have people in the past, they like you, they love you. You do a bit of qualitative research after purchase. You understand how they work. You feed them value. You tease them with products. And on Black Friday, give them a damn discount. They're going to be happy. They're going to buy it. And they're going to continue buying from you instead. You just treat them like everyone else. And that's why brands lose customers, because the biggest reason is they think the brand doesn't care about them.
I love it. Here's question number three. Okay. So both you and I, we both believe in outcomes over output. So, what are the 3 to 5 things, that you think can be influenced when you can focus outcomes over outputs?
The outcomes are basically the benefit that your customer get from your stuff. So in an e-commerce world, it all starts with you truly understanding your customer needs, their challenges, their issues, their struggling moments, their forces of progress, everything. So if you are able to understand these things, you are able to work on doing things that benefit the customer, but not in only terms of products and services and profits and revenue, which is the output part. So as an e-commerce, obviously it's great for you to focus on delivering great products. You have to do services, you have to do profits. It's great. It's important. Of course, outputs are very important. But at the same time, if you focus on outcomes are meaningful, right? It's the relationships that you've been. This is the difference between you and your competitor. And it's the why, you understand? So it's why are you doing this? So, outputs are great, but they are the enablers of outcomes, right? I hope I make sense. Because without having an outcome, there's no need for an output. And that's my take. Absolutely. That's my take. Yeah, I love this topic. And I actually was reading this Harvard Business Review article about this. And the problem with people understanding the difference between output and outcomes is not just the semantics of it, right? That's something that stuck in my head. And I've been working in the product department for so long. And for me, the focus was always, oh my God, let's do this, let's fix this. This is very important. But at the end of the day, it's not. You have to look for the benefits at the broader level, not just for the short, ones. Because if you don't have, the what, the why doesn't matter, or it is, and the other way around. And it's a great question. Yeah, thank you for that.
Awesome. All right, let's move to question number four. So as a marketer, if you had to change one thing to adapt to buying behavior, what would that be?
As a marketer to adapt to buying behavior?
Yes.
First, the most important thing to stimulate the buyer to purchase is to do qualitative research. I know a lot of people say qualitative research is bullshit. I disagree with them. Yes, there are people that do bullshit custom qualitative research, But I think it's very important that if you have any doubts in your head about what that customer wants, needs, or thinks about, you just have to go to the source, which is the customer. A lot of marketing happens in the conference room. Yeah. A lot of people go in conference rooms and have this long conversation about who's our buyer persona, and they put a picture and the name and they give them three treats and they say, okay, this is my buyer persona. Okay, this is my ideal customer profile. That's a very big difference between the two. And then they go and they move all their marketing efforts to these fictional people that they just dream about all night and talk about the next day in the conference room. And I think it's crap. I think if you want to understand how your customer thinks and how you can adapt yourself to their behavior and to understand their behavior to stimulate them to purchase more is to go and ask them. A very good way, and I advise everyone to look into this, is the jobs to be done method, which basically, so long story short, because it's done by Harvard, by Clay Christensen. It's basically a way for you to understand what is the job that a person hired your product for. So you hire a product, but behind that hiring of the product, there's emotions, there's struggle. There's something that, you know, you might, it's like, I'll give you the best example. I wanted to buy my baby a stroller that, you know, with a lot of toys on it. I wanted to buy it, but I didn't buy it. I wanted to. I was looking at it. I was saying, no, I'm not going to buy this. I'm not going to buy this. But I had it in the back of my mind, but I didn't make up my decision. It wasn't the money. It was nothing. This last 3 days, he's teething right now. So it's very hard to calm him down. So because I was struggling on calming him down, I got the emotions that, you know, maybe I'm not a good mother. I don't know what to do anymore. I forgot how to take care of a baby. And that forced me, those were the forces that moved me to go and buy that damn stroller with toys and whatever so I can put him into it and calm him down. And maybe if he sleeps, I sleep. So this is the power of the jobs to be done method. You interview your customer to understand what is the job that they hire your product to do. And if I have time, and I would love to just, this is something that's worth mentioning. The guy that I heard about jobs to be done from, it's called, his name is Bob Moesta. Bob Moesta is an incredible person. You need to look him out if you don't already know about him. So I was at his workshop last year before COVID. So he was working in the sneakers campaign. You know that sneaker has that thing, you're not you where you're hungry. So he was telling me that he was in the airport thinking about how they're going to solve the issue between, they were basically thinking that sneakers is the competition of Milky Way. So he was in the airport thinking about how to do this. I don't remember exactly where he said he was flying to, but he saw a person in line at one of those airport shops that was buying a sneakers. And then he went to that person and asked, why are you buying the sneakers? And the person said, I'm hungry. So, and he asked, why don't you buy something else? He was like, I don't want to buy something else because it's not going to sustain me. I need to fly for 2 hours somewhere else. I need to eat something real quick just to get over being hungry. So apparently that's the way how sneakers came up with you're not you when you're hungry. And they realized they're not in competition with Milky Way and they're on their own level of, you know, of a product category. And they only found that by asking the customer and the consumer. So yeah, this is to be able to adapt yourself to the buyer journey, to deliver value on the other side to your customer, but also increase your revenues and your brand authority and your branding in general as an e-commerce shop, you need to talk to your customers. Those are the answers, not in the conference room, not with the agency that does, you don't see me, but I'm doing air quotes right now on qualitative research, but that's how you're supposed to do. Just go and call them. I get a lot of clients that have 4,000 people or 1,000 people that bought from them. And I'm saying you don't need retention. You just need to pick up the phone and call all of them. Take your time as owner this week and call everyone and ask them how do they feel about your product. Yeah, it's time consuming. I get it. But it's so worth it. You will understand how are they feeling. And that's my answer, Yag. I hope it was what you were looking for.
No, I'm absolutely loving it. I would almost virtually high five you because I know how much I hate drawing a persona and even naming it. Some companies name it.
No, I know, John, the marketing enthusiast.
Yes, exactly. All right. Here's the final question in the rapid fire round for you. And this is going to be very easy. If you were to give a shout out to a few people or maybe someone who has been your biggest inspiration and support, feel free to do it now.
Oh, wow. It's not even a brain. No, it's a no-brainer. I want to give a shout out to Valentin because he gave me a chance 2 years ago when he hired me. Because I'm, you know me better than Manish. I'm this, I have the energy to light up a whole town in general. And I went to an interview with him. I applied for the job on LinkedIn for a product owner job. He called me in 30 minutes. I was so excited because I was a fan. I was a fan of him. And when he called me, I was like, oh my God, is this really you? Very stupid thing to say. And yeah, he called me to the office in the same day. And we ended up talking for 3 hours. I got hired on the spot, which is a cool thing. It never happened to me before. And it's just that he gave me so much space to grow and learn, and gave me so much access to resources and to him as a person. And I just learned from him. I just learned from how he moves, how he speaks. And a lot of the things that I shared with you today in terms of the questions that you asked and the answers is things that I learned from him, is things that I learned from the market, is things that I learned from the books he recommends me to read. And he's been overall an amazing person and inspiration for me. And every day, you know, I'm just grateful for having, you know, someone in my life that I can look up to and is there for me all the time. And yeah, I want to say thank you, Valentin, and I'm grateful. I'm very, very grateful.
That was great, Juliana. You said you're not prepared for the rapid fire round. Trust me, nobody is ready for the rapid fire round, but you did really great.
I hope.
Well, we also loved every bit of the conversation we had with you today. Thank you for joining us today, and thank you for making first party data hot again. If you had to give one takeaway message to our listeners of the podcast today, what would that be?
Wow. Should it be commerce related or a general message?
It's open to anything that you are up to.
Well, my first message would be to stop creating buyer personas in the conference room and stop making Facebook and Google Ads pockets fat and look in your own backyard for answers, because sometimes the answers are just, you know, they're staring at you in the face. And if you hear this podcast episode for the first time with me, you should go back and listen to the other episodes of the podcast, which are probably better than this one, but they are amazing. And I'm very grateful that you guys had me. I had a lot of fun. And this is one of the, you know, the nicest podcasts I've been in the sense that I have fun and the questions were amazing. So people that listen to this because I shared that on LinkedIn, go back and listen to all the episodes, because this is, in my opinion, one of the best podcasts right now in marketing. So yeah, that's my message.
Thank you so much. You're so kind. You're really kind. Thank you for the nice words for the ABM Conversation podcast. And where would you send people online if they want to say hi or DM you about something based on all the things that we discussed today?
They can reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'm Juliana Jackson there. They can find me. I'm connected to you and Yalk. So if they know you, they will find me, you know, in your connections. Unless they want to sell me some Forex trading, I'm good. Besides that, I'm great. They can reach out to me on LinkedIn, and I'm happy to help anyone that needs a bit of guidance.
Amazing. Once again, thank you, Juliana, for being with us today. And for the listeners tuned in right now, we will be back with yet another listen-worthy episode of the AVM Conversations podcast next week. Until then, this is your host, Manish Nepal, signing off.
And this is bye from me, Yag. Take care.
Bye, guys.
Thanks for listening to the ABM Conversations podcast. Make sure you subscribe and share your comments with us. We're constantly looking for your feedback, thoughts, and suggestions to make the show more relevant to you.